We're going to be joined in a moment here by Dr. Raymond Peets, who's an expert physiologist, chemist, research scientist, and we're going to be hearing from Dr. Raymond Peets about some helpful things to do to counter any potential radioactive spread to this country. It was probably earlier in the week that I first started finding some internet-based evidence to show that the spread of radiation from the steam leaked from the plant subsequent to the explosions, the hydrogen explosions on the actual buildings, not the containment vessel for the reactor, but the buildings that housed all of the reactor and all the machinery, that steam was laden with things like iodine-131 and cesium isotopes, and that these had been released in the steam cloud as the engineers desperately tried to lower the pressure by allowing the steam from the reactor to leave so it didn't cause any further breakdown of the containment vessel, which would certainly result in fairly widespread and very damaging radioactive release. And one of the reactors, number three, the mixed oxide fuel reactor that contained the plutonium, 6% plutonium and 94% uranium, that would lead to a much more serious environmental damage if that was released. Okay, so we started coming out on Wednesday, I think it was. I first started seeing some spreading clouds, as it were, in colour, showing a potential spread to the East Coast. And then the CTBTO from Vienna released information, and it became widespread public knowledge. It was no longer something that was on the fringes, but fairly widespread public knowledge. And today, that was on Thursday, and today, on Friday, quite a few government agencies are also admitting this. So on Wednesday or Tuesday of last week, they started saying that the radioactive components would be in the upper atmosphere, spread by the jet stream, moving east, and due to hit the Aleutian Islands on Thursday, and then be on the west coast of America with a spread potentially from Oregon down to California. So yesterday I read the CTBO report online, and indeed this cloud was coming fairly close and was expected to make landfall by Friday. So funnily enough, today in Sacramento, now the CTBTO is the center, the basically the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization that was set up to monitor the atmosphere for radioactive particles, isotopes, emissions from nuclear testing. There's a comprehensive test ban on nuclear explosions, and these sites, there are 60 of them around the world, and these sites actually measure radiation released from nuclear explosions. So the ones in the Pacific were starting to detect this, and actually in Vienna they released the information. I think it was, I don't know if it was a mole or an insider who just wanted to make sure that it got out, because as well as radioactive data, the CTBTO collects geophysical information, so it's seismic activity, tsunami activity, and on top of that, the third thing they do is maintain and monitor any radioactive release as a telltale signature from nuclear explosions. Okay, so they started picking this up, and then on Thursday it was released from Vienna, and they said on Friday it would be making landfall in California. And actually today, one of the CTBO stations based in Sacramento actually recorded very small, so although they're very small, they're present particles of iodine, I-131, and so, you know, it's fairly real that what we have in the upper air jet stream and or coming down in the rain is potentially going to land here, and that's something we should just be aware of. At this point in time, it's still, I would safely say, still fairly small, but it's certainly coming this way all the time now. It's made its first landfall from when it first started. The fires broke out on Saturday or Sunday of last week, and so for the last 5 days, the cloud trail has been coming east. So
we're joined by Dr. Ray Peets today, and I want to introduce Dr. Peets and then also ask him from his sources if he believes it true that the radioactive iodine has reached our land yet.
It's probably present in detectable amounts, but probably not yet biologically significant, but it could quickly become concentrated enough to affect pregnant women. because the fetus concentrates elements from the environment at least 100 times faster than other tissues. And so during the first 2 or 3 months after an accident like that, there will be radioactive iodine, which would be concentrating in the embryo and fetus. Other isotopes such as cesium and strontium would continue to be dangerous if they got into the food supply, but the radioactive iodine is the one that's most crucial for developing babies.
So, Dr. Pete, we wanted to go over and discuss what different foods and nutrients could help protect us from increasing levels, if it does increase, or more dangerous levels of radioactive iodine that may be present, and or cesium and or strontium from this cloud that is coming over from Japan. And we wanted to go through the list of different things that specifically can block those radioactive particles, as well as, in general, what nutrients are protective.
The first principle is to dilute the radioactive isotopes with good, stable, or relatively stable isotopes. And so old food is best. The iodine radioactive isotope is practically all gone after 3 months after the production of it. And the others will eventually tend to wash down into the ground. And so the plants that grow in the first few months after an accident will contain those isotopes. So if you have canned food, dried milk, or aged cheese, these are very safe and will continue to be safe for months because they were produced before the accident. The other principle besides diluting the isotopes is to increase your resistance to stress and radiation. And it happened that my very first newsletter 30 years ago was on radiation resistance and what to do in case of a nuclear accident. And at that time, I reviewed a couple thousand research articles, both from the old AEC, Atomic Energy Commission research, and a lot of it from the Soviet research. And the main conclusions that I found were that increasing the metabolic rate, which causes cells to retain magnesium. Magnesium is very important in repairing cell damage, and the faster the metabolic rate is, generally the more damage can be repaired before it becomes established as a stress factor in the organism. The high metabolic rate produces carbon dioxide, which has an antioxidant, anti-stress effect all through the organism. So if you keep your metabolic rate up and eat a balanced diet, your tissue's going to retain the magnesium it needs out of the food and produce the carbon dioxide it needs, assuming that you're getting adequate protein, sugar, fat, vitamins, and a balance of minerals.
So you mentioned to me earlier that there are ways and foods that we can eat to keep our metabolic rate high, as along with taking thyroid. So can you expand on what types of sugars and fats and proteins we should be ingesting?
The ideal fat is coconut oil, because the short-chain saturated fatty acids compete with the other fats that normally are slowing metabolism and oxidative metabolism. And so for a couple hours, after you eat more or less a tablespoon of coconut oil per meal for a couple hours, your metabolic rate is increased, producing more carbon dioxide and accelerating cell repair processes. And the fruits that come from the tropics, the farther south the fruit is grown, the longer it will be free of this high-latitude Japanese radiation. So oranges grown in Mexico, Brazil, and Florida are still going to be pretty pure in terms of radiation for a very long time. And the sugar and the minerals in oranges are very close to what we need. So coconut oil, orange juice, and milk as a good source of calcium. During the atmospheric bomb tests in the 50s and 60s, I got interested in the study the government was doing, they were doing it secretly before it became public for a long time, but they were collecting baby teeth from around the world to measure the fallout effects. And the government began recommending that people not drink milk because milk was contaminated with the strontium, which was taken up along with the calcium. But I looked at the actual analysis of the food value as well as the isotope content of vegetables and found that a person getting their nutrition from vegetables was going to have about five times higher exposure to strontium 90 than people who got their nutrition primarily from milk and cheese, because the cows were able to concentrate the calcium and filter out a little more of the strontium than the vegetables were doing.
Yeah, you mentioned to me that in order to get enough calcium to protect against your body's own bone destruction, that you would have to drink 1 to 2 quarts and the same amount of and eat some cheese daily, and that same amount of calcium from green leafy vegetables would be about 3 pounds of spinach per day.
Something like that, yeah.
And then the fact that you're eating so much spinach that could have been contaminated with strontium, you'd actually be exposing yourself to much higher levels of strontium.
Yeah.
And what can you talk to us about what you'd recommend for elimination methods, like if we are breathing in or ingesting radioactive particles? What's the best elimination method you find to take? Because I know there's a lot of stuff on the Internet about all these different things you can take that will help bind the radioactive particles. But what do you recommend, Dr. Pete?
Well, once it gets into your digestive system, if it's coming in incorporated in the food, there's really no way to sort it out. But if it's in the water, for example, if you can just keep a lot of fiber flowing through your system, like eating fruit that you know isn't contaminated, carrots, for example, if you know that they're safely grown uncontaminated, will sweep the material through your intestine, preventing the absorption of some nutrients at the same time. But if you're exposed to a very concentrated dose from a rain or something, it's better to go hungry for a little while sweeping out your intestine.
So would you consider, just to kind of go back a little bit here, but would you consider the radiation that we might have been exposed to thus far dangerous enough to avoid drinking any milk and eating any vegetables from California and Oregon?
Oh no, not yet.
Not yet.
If it becomes, if the reactors start burning fuel rods, someone is likely to leak the information in time that people can take precautions. But if it reached the proportions of Chernobyl, then it would take extreme measures for a very long time, using only stored antique food. The older food would become more valuable.
So it sounds like we need to start stocking up on sugar and dried milk powder.
Yeah.
Okay, and other things that can help move things along in the intestine are all the various liver herbs and cascara bark powder. All speeds intestinal transit time. But I did want to ask you, Dr. Pete, there's a lot of hype around people using potassium iodide already, and it's selling out of the stores, and people using kelp. And can you please explain to our listeners how taking kelp or the potassium iodide supplement would help protect them against the high amount of radioactive iodine in our environment?
It simply dilutes the radioactive isotope when you're taking in a lot of old, stable iodine. It saturates your thyroid, and your thyroid shuts down and stops taking up any more. And so you can add radioactive iodine to a saturated person, and it just gradually washes out without concentrating at a very high level in the thyroid. But if a person is deficient in iodine, almost all of it will, once it gets into the bloodstream, it'll stick in the thyroid gland and give an extremely high dose to the gland, and even more so to a developing embryo's thyroid gland. The fetus will concentrate even more than the mother's thyroid.
The
potassium iodide is very good protection, but only from the damage to the thyroid gland. It doesn't do anything at all to protect against the other isotopes or the other tissues of the body, as some people are saying on the internet. In fact, it probably, if you took it more than enough to saturate your tissues, the Center for Disease Control advocates 160 milligrams one dose. If you took that much every day for a long time, your thyroid gland would shut down. Your metabolism would slow down, and you would, all of your defensive reactions would slow down, so you would become more susceptible to injury throughout the rest of your body.
So you're not recommending that people take any kelp powder or potassium iodide at this current level?
No, just the minimum requirement is only 150 or 200 micrograms, and even 1 milligram per day continued for a very long time increases the risk of damage to the thyroid gland. Thyroiditis appears increasingly when people eat just a milligram of iodine or more.
And do you know the measurements on how much is in kelp powder? How many milligrams is in a teaspoon of kelp or a half a teaspoon of kelp?
No, but probably a half teaspoon. I think people have calculated that it would take an ounce to be equal to the Center for Disease Control amount, but probably a half teaspoon is adequate to saturate most people.
But only once we have more information saying there is actually elevated levels of radioactive iodine in our environment?
Yeah, one half teaspoon dose isn't going to hurt anyone, but you don't want to do that every day for a long time.
Andrew, did you have a question?
I think what was, like you were saying, Sarah, the rush on buying potassium iodide was pretty apparent. I know I saw plenty of information regarding that. And the thing with iodine, if I'm right in saying this, Dr. Pete, is that the radioactive iodine that was present in Chernobyl was also responsible for the big increase in thyroid cancers. And now you're saying that pregnant women are actually more susceptible even than young children.
Ernest Sternglass, who got interested in the issue when they were doing atmospheric bomb tests. The government timed their bomb tests in Nevada so that the wind wasn't blowing towards the big California cities. They wanted all of the fallout to go into Utah, and the population of Utah suffered the most from autoimmune diseases and cancer and other diseases. But occasionally the rainfall would be so light that no fallout would come down until it got to the East Coast. And one of these times, Ernest Sternglass had his students studying how to use their Geiger counters, and they found that there was a terrific amount of radiation at the university, which the government hadn't mentioned to anyone. Mm-hmm. And that got him studying it and paying attention to how dishonest the U.S. Public Health Service and Atomic Energy Commission and state public health officials were. Mm-hmm. He showed that probably there were tens of thousands of miscarriages, and the babies that survived, a very high percentage, were hypothyroid. Even there was an epidemic of babies born without their thyroid glands. Mm. And as long as they were being breastfed, the mother's thyroid was entering the milk at a high enough level to cover up the symptoms. So as soon as they were weaned, they were discovered not to have thyroid glands.
Going back to cover-ups or suppression of information, I found it quite interesting from the moment the tsunami happened and the evolving situation at Fukushima was passing day by day with ever increasing explosions, etc. I found the most information, funnily enough, coming from Russia today. That news agency there, I think, probably not suppressed so much by the West as the BBC even. I found the BBC's coverage was pretty good, but I found Russia's Today, their coverage was pretty excellent, and they had the most up-to-date information, I presume, because of the time zone. They were much more on a par with Japan. So in the waking hours, they were picking up the information as soon as it was being released from sources in Japan. But I wonder what would be the best, I guess, to keep monitoring Russia Today, but the best source for people in America to be able to find out more about local results with real time and real figures to show what actually is in the environment. I wonder what would be the best way to go about doing that.
I don't remember the web address, but there is a good nuclear site and basically an anti-nuclear power site that is getting up-to-date information.
So the other thing was, I was looking on eBay at Geiger counters, of all things, just to see. You know, they're out there. There's hundreds of them on eBay, and they're not expensive. And I think a lot of them are kind of post-Cold War, post-Three Mile Island. So the getting hold of a Geiger counter to actually do some physical measurements yourself.
For a while, the internet stores were selling old Soviet Geiger counters that for about $15. Uh-huh. And someone just told me that she and her neighbor had bought two at $35, and as soon as the radiation scare hit, the price went up to $75.
Oh my gosh. Okay, because I saw them on eBay and they were going for about $150 to $200, and these were I can get hold of the information pretty quick, but they were all fairly similar. They were kind of bright yellow and maybe about the size of an egg carton. Yeah.
So I'm actually holding mine right here, which I got on the internet.
Oh, okay.
I could have paid anywhere. You know, I got the cheapest, basically, which cost me about $250.
Right.
I did see even cheaper ones other places, but the really good expensive ones cost $10,000 to $20,000. And the little booklet I got with this, you know, I can tell some kinds of radiation from other kinds. But I basically have it beeping, and I got it to check out both industrial metals and phosphate fertilizers. And I did find some things which are definitely hot by mine.
Yeah.
It's not beeping much more than normal right now, though.
Good. All right, let's get back to some of those things that people can.
Yeah, we do have a caller on the line, but I did want to at least go through a few more of the anti-radiation nutrients. Dr. Pete, caffeine. There's lots of information out there about tea and coffee, and can you describe to us briefly what the nutrients are in the in the tea and the coffee, and how caffeine helps to protect against radiation?
Coffee is a good source of magnesium and of some B vitamins, niacin especially, and the caffeine is anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, and so if you happen to have some mobile isotopes that are still in your bloodstream and going through your kidneys, caffeine helps to flush them out faster and safely. It has a slight chelating effect as well as anti-inflammatory.
Carry on.
The things that have an anti-estrogen effect as well as anti-inflammatory, the radiation effect itself imitates estrogen in the body. Everything that estrogen does can be imitated by radiation, including making a rat go into estrus, for example. And if you're in a high estrogen state, then you're more susceptible to radiation injury. And that's why progesterone and thyroid and caffeine, by helping to lower estrogen and inflammation, are protective against radiation too.
So just to recap those, you said caffeine, coffee, because it contains a magnesium and B vitamins, progesterone to block the estrogenic effects of radiation, other antioxidants like vitamin E also blocks the effects of estrogen and helps with radiation, and vitamin C in orange juice and tropical fruits. Vitamin A found in eggs and liver helps in the repair processes. I wanted to briefly ask you about the glutathione that's been touted to help with radiation damages.
There's a lot of confusion around glutathione because anything that harms your cells turns on a defensive reaction and increases the glutathione. And so a lot of things that have exactly the wrong effect are being suggested on the basis of increasing glutathione, but many harmful things by stimulating that defense reaction will increase glutathione, and taking a large dose of glutathione in itself, animal studies showed that it could be carcinogenic to the liver just by starting free radical reactions rather than stopping them.
Other anti-inflammatories that can help protect against radiation, aspirin, of course, which comes from white willow bark. Well, not anymore, but originated from white willow bark. Also, ginkgo, turmeric, those are other herbal anti-inflammatories. Various adaptogenic adrenal herbs, Eleuthera root, American and Korean ginseng have been shown to help with radiation sickness. And we mentioned the B vitamins already. I wanted you, Dr. Pete, to talk to us about animal liver, which contains a lot of B vitamins and the fat-soluble A, D, E, and K vitamins, and why it's, contrary to popular opinion, it's actually less toxic than the other parts of the animal.
The liver is the main detoxifying organ. The kidneys and brain have some of the same detoxifying enzymes, but the liver is where the great bulk of detoxification happens. And there have been studies in which beef were going into the slaughterhouse. Their urine, blood, and tissues were measured, and the a large proportion of the animals, more than a third, showed chemical contamination in the blood and urine, and practically all of them had the same chemicals in their fat and muscle tissues, the meats that are most popular, but only a very tiny proportion still had any of the toxic chemicals left in their liver. For the first 24 hours after you're exposed to a insecticide, for example, it will collect in the liver and be bound to a certain kind of protein. But during this first day in which it's collecting at a high concentration in the liver begins destroying it. And after just about 24 hours, the liver has cleaned itself and then begins the slow process of cleaning the blood as it draws toxins out of the muscles and fat tissues. The fats are relatively inert, and so the highest toxins accumulate there over the years. And so the fatty meats are the most risky as far as the chemical poisonings go. The liver's the cleanest.
Okay, good. There's a caller on the line, so let's start taking the callers, because there may well be one behind the other.
Hi. Hello, fellow downwinders of the vast nuclear corporate industrial empire. I've been watching the news, and I saw maybe it was the website that Dr. Pete mentioned, a nuclear information site. It was on the news. A couple of programs had the plume coming from Japan, and it indicated that the very first place where it was hitting the west coast was actually Cape Mendocino, from about Eureka to Fort Bragg. That was like at 11 o'clock last night they were showing that map. So we're the initial fallout point of that particular plume. And I have a couple of questions concerning it. The first one, before I forget, the first the colon cleanser that you mentioned, I didn't quite catch the name of that. What was it again?
Grated carrot.
Raw carrot.
Sorry, once again?
Raw carrot salad. Like raw
carrots. Oh, raw carrots. Okay.
And
I had a little static on the line when on the radio when you had mentioned that. And I understand also garlic is supposed to help bring iodine into the system. Is that something that you're aware of?
Dr. Pete?
What was that?
Garlic.
Garlic. Oh. it has some antioxidant effect, but I don't think it has a big effect on iodine.
Okay. And then this weekend we're trying to safeguard ourselves with our potassium iodine salad, which is bananas and seaweed. Is there, if we don't really, go out and eat a whole lot of it, I don't know what the flavor is, but it's got to be better than the tasteless plutonium and uranium that's literally raining down on us. Is there a cautionary amount that you would eat of some kind of fruit/sea salad like that would be reasonable to start maybe implementing some protection?
Dr. Pete, did you hear that question?
The last part of it I couldn't hear.
Okay, well, basically, he's suggesting eating a banana and seaweed salad provide potassium.
The seaweed, kelp and dulse, for example, or sea organisms like shrimp and oysters and clams, those are good sources of iodine. But the banana issue brings up an important aspect of radiation, which is bananas are probably one of the richest food sources in serotonin. And biologists, Carmel Mothersill and Colin Seymour, for example, have been studying the effects of low-level radiation on cell physiology and communication, and they find that at a very low level, ionizing radiation causes cells to produce serotonin, among other agents, that even if you take the injured cells out of the organism or the culture dish, the water that they were in when they were injured becomes equivalent to the radiation for other cells. The same kind of genetic damage caused directly by the radiation can be caused by the chemicals put into the environment by those injured cells. And serotonin at a level above 20 nanograms per milliliter is one of those communicators of radiation damage. They, in one of their books, have a study by some of the biologists who worked with the Chernobyl victims, both the children who have been living in the region and the people who survived working at the accident. And they find that the serum taken from these exposed people, 20 years after the accident, their serum separated from their blood components, added to another person's cells, caused radiation damage equivalent in those cells. And since they identified a very small amount of serotonin as one of the factors spreading this inflammation, genetic destabilizing material, I think it's good to avoid as many sources of serotonin as possible, especially bananas.
Good.
So when it said that somebody is going bananas, there's actually a pharmaceutical psychological aspect to that, it sounds like. Well, I guess I'll be adding raw carrots to our salad and reducing the amount of bananas. Is there any benefit to eating dried bananas to fresh bananas considering the psychopharmaceutical aspects of the serotonin in there?
Shifting towards gelatinous meats away from muscle meats would help to reduce the tendency of the tissues when inflamed to produce serotonin. A good balance of vitamins and minerals helps to avoid excess serotonin production during inflammation, but all of those inflammatory, anti-inflammatory things that have been mentioned are basically anti-serotonin.
And my final question on estrogenics for, concerning ingestion by men. I don't know if saw palmetto is one of those, but are there anything that maybe should be taken to preempt the estrogenic effect of the radionuclides as far as the difference between men ingesting them and women ingesting them? Or is it at a point where maybe drinking water out of a plastic bottle with a bisphenol A is better than dealing with the radionuclides that might preempt it at least over the next couple of weeks? And thank you very much for the program. I'm going to release the line.
Thank you for your call. Dr. Pete, did you hear that gentleman's
almost
last...
Almost none of it.
Okay, yeah, we have a little bit of feedback here. So he was asking about the anti-estrogenic, what else could be taken at... what else could men take that's anti-estrogen to help protect against the radionucleotides? And also whether you would recommend people drink bottled water versus water from spring or well in the next several months.
Given that the bottled water is a potential source of estrogenic substances.
I think a good filter for well water is is adequate.
Okay. And progesterone is very anti-estrogenic.
And for men, keeping the thyroid function high is the main thing. Aspirin and thyroid are able to inhibit the estrogen that's produced as a result of stress.
Okay. I've actually just thought of something. And in the water filter, is the, because we have water filters that we run our water through, and I know that the core of the filter is a pleated carbon core. Is that carbon there, is that able to sequester things like iodine if it was in the water?
Yeah, I think carbon catches almost any any solid will absorb to activated charcoal.
Right. Okay, good. All right, there's two more callers on the line, so let's take the next one. You're on the air?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Well, the brown seaweeds like wakame and kombu, especially kombu, are high in sodium alginate, and they're supposed to take all heavy metals and radioactivity out of your body, just not the iodine. So don't you think they would be good?
Did you hear that, Dr. Pete?
Yeah. If they pass through your intestine.
Well, yes, eating them.
They aren't going to be any more effective than good cellulose. Anything indigestible that stimulates your intestine will sweep
even
out.
Even with the sodium alginate?
Well, the trouble is that alginate is very dangerously allergenic for many people, so I wouldn't recommend it unless you are sure that you're not sensitive to it, because
I don't know one person that eats the kombu that's ever had an allergy to it.
Dental patients have died, and dental students, a very high proportion of the dental students working with alginate to make molds, surprisingly healthy young
dental
students.
Well, that's a concentrate that they made, not a whole food product.
Carrageenan is somewhat worse, but alginate itself has the potential to be dangerously allergenic.
Okay.
I think in light of raw carrots being so absorptive in the intestinal tract and non-digestible, meaning that if they were contaminated themselves, when you eat them, you're not going to be absorbing heavy metals. And when they wash through your intestinal tract, they're going to be absorbing potential heavy metals and radioactive particles.
Oh, well, I think carrots are a good idea, but so is seaweed, I think.
Well, see, it's taking too much seaweed will actually lower your metabolic rate and
well,
make
too
you...
too much, yes.
Well, even eating it daily is enough. It doesn't take that much in order to start suppressing the thyroid.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. There's another caller on the line. You're on the air?
Oh, hello. Yes, what I recommend using is mushrooms. There's this mushroom right around here called the turkey tail, Trimedes versicolor. And this one is actually, in Asia, is used as an anti-cancer drug because it has a high quality protein-bound polysaccharide, which is discovered very effective in cancer. And also in treating cancer patients that had chemotherapy in their survival rates and stuff. It also has other qualities that are free radical oxidizing compounds and all kinds of things like that. And other mushrooms are the same quality, which are called polypore mushrooms, which is the riche is one.
Mm-hmm.
And these big thick conchs that grow like wood-like looking mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
And these mushrooms have been studied in Japan and around and have been proven to produce, you know, the T cell production and what is that, interleukin production?
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you know anything about that.
Dr. P, how much do you know about those particular fungi?
Oh, what was the name of the...
Well, he mentioned things like the polyphores, the...
The turkey tail is the one that grows around here.
Yeah.
It's most common, and I make a tea from it just by drying it in dust in a powder.
Okay. Do you know that fungi?
It's like the most... It actually is the most studied fungi in the world as far as medicinal.
Okay.
Are you speaking about reishi?
No,
it's related to reishi. It's also a polypore mushroom. It's a thick mushroom that around here, if you look on these trees, there's these just layers of these mushrooms. They're like tri-colored mushrooms. They're called turkey tails. They go like green and brown and with a white edge. And they grow on all like the oak trees, the maple, all basically hardwood trees. And they're the most common mushroom probably in the world. They grow in the most from boreal forest to tropical forest. And in every state in the union except for, I think, Nevada or something.
I think a lot of the...
And they've been studied all over the world. And they actually make this commercial thing it calls Creston, it's actually called. It's an anti-cancer drug in Asia.
Okay, I've not heard of it, but...
I think a lot of the mushrooms have the polysaccharides that are active at absorbing a lot of things from the gastrointestinal tract.
Right, and that's what I was saying. They use them in chemotherapy and stuff like that. So I'm just saying that... well, they also have, you know, for other types of things besides antioxidizing compounds. But so I always take mushrooms anyway. I'm a big fan of them, and I would recommend that people use this mushroom. It's growing right on it. You look under your oak tree, your apple tree, your bay tree over here. On the ground, and you look at the dead branches, and you see it's covered with these mushrooms.
All right.
They're very dry. They're dry mushroom.
All right.
And that is called the turkey tail.
Okay. Well, people can check that out on the internet and find out some more about
it.
Yes, I'm not too familiar with it.
Yeah. And it has been used with Rachet.
Okay. I'm familiar with Rachet.
Yeah. And that's another one of the probably. And the other one that around here is. Are those, you ever see those mushrooms that are like, they look like a piece of wood, real heavy, thick things growing off of a tree?
Yeah, I've seen
They're
those.
They're called conchs, right?
Yeah.
And that one too has been, has the same qualities.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you for your call.
Right.
I know there's a couple of other people probably want to get a question in, so let's take the next caller.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air?
All right, so I have a great website. The EPA has revamped for the general public, so we can easily access the graphical representation of the raw data of the monitoring sites along the West Coast.
Okay, and that is?
So you can see the actual gamma and beta radiation levels.
What's the name of the site?
Hourly?
What's the website?
Okay, here it comes. You guys ready?
Yep.
I know people are waiting.
Yep.
World Wide Web. epa.gov/japan2011/RERT/radnet RADNET -data.html.
Okay, good. Well, maybe we'll
get all that?
I wrote it all down.
So
okay, great.
Okay, let's try it.
It's really handy. I already looked at it. We haven't seen anything unusual anywhere yet.
Okay.
So,
okay, it was just the one thing
in that department.
After 2011 /RERT, you said?
Japan 2011 /RERT.
Right.
Okay, that's
/radnet.
Okay.
-data.html.
Check.
Okay, good. Well, people can go check that website out and then see how that compares to the CTBTO information, especially the one that was published from Vienna on Thursday.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you for having the discussion.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Okay, bye.
Are there any more callers
online?
Yes,
there is.
Okay, good. Okay. Go ahead. You're on the air?
Yes, I was wondering about using D-ribose to raise the metabolic rate.
Okay.
Dr. Pete, did you hear that question?
D-ribose?
Yeah.
D-ribose.
I think the main risk is that those things are produced industrially very often have contaminants that no one knows about or mentions on the labels, and so you have to be very cautious that you don't have an allergic reaction to any of those semi-purified chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there we go. Was that the only question? Okay, all right. I think they've dropped up anyway. Was there any more callers on the line? Okay, so let's go back to. The useful things and that people can do, given that there is an increase in radioactive contamination, if that plays out. I think particularly the thing that I'm thinking about, Dr. Pete, is if that third reactor, the mixed oxide fuel reactor, actually becomes a fire, or the fuel rods in the pools actually become combusted, and there are release of that fuel, the plutonium particularly, is the dangerous, the very dangerous and very long half-life isotope, isn't it?
Yeah, at that point I think people should either, if they can't move to Bolivia, they should think about building a giant greenhouse and getting some goats and chickens to live in the greenhouse with them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I hope it doesn't come to that, for sure. I think there's one more caller on the line, so let's take this caller.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I did come in late, so I'm sorry if I missed the answer, but you were talking about various vitamins and their...
Could you turn your radio down? Sorry.
I'm sorry. I was trying to step away. Okay. You were talking about various vitamins, and are you suggesting only get those from a whole food, or what about supplements from a reputable company like Rainbow Light or something like that?
Well, I think Dr. Pete's always recommending fresh fruits and so, but Dr. Pete?
For an emergency, like just for a period of 2 or 3 weeks while the cloud passes over, I think it could be, for most people, it could be helpful to take a B complex supplement and to eat extra eggs and milk and very nutrient rich foods, but a B vitamin supplement is pretty safe and helps to keep a maximal rate of metabolism supported.
Okay, did you you heard that okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
And so will there be a place to go to hear the whole show tonight?
You can pick it up online at kmud.org.
Okay.
And then what you do
and
is
then
you...
go to the audio archives, yeah.
Oh, thank
And then
you.
Under audio archives, you'll find the third Friday of each month. There will be a Friday night talk, it's called. It's from 7 till 8 p.m.
Yeah, just search via the date.
Okay.
Which today is March 18th.
Yeah, so yeah. Go to Friday Night Talk and it's all there.
Excellent. It's been a great show. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now,
thanks for your call.
Okay, yeah, I know we've got 5 minutes to the hour of 8 o'clock, so unfortunately it's coming to an end. Were there any more callers on? No, okay, there's no more callers, so let's...
Okay, so Dr. P, if cesium, the half-life is 30 years, and it's supposedly heavier than iodine, do you think it's true that more is likely to fall out over the Pacific Ocean before it gets here? Or I wonder if there's even sites showing that it is here.
I think there would be a little bit of everything that was produced. There would be only a very slight difference in fallout in the rainfall.
Yeah.
And going back to potassium, I know that caller was asking about bananas, but orange juice is very rich in potassium, and potassium will also help your body pick up less cesium, like the kelp will help your the iodine, and the kelp will help your body pick up less radioactive iodine.
If 50 years ago, I proposed that the safe thing would be to have industrial-sized greenhouses, which if they were going to keep doing the atmospheric bomb tests, I suggested that all vegetables should be grown in either petroleum or coal-fired greenhouses, providing fossil carbon dioxide to avoid the radioactive carbon isotope from the fallout, and using limestone as the safe source of calcium for fertilizer, and other fossil minerals to give the complete non-radioactive food source for the plants and animals that were being used for food. By 1963, the government had agreed to stop testing in the atmosphere. One of the reasons that I did my newsletter in 1981 on radiation protection was that beginning with that huge burst of atmospheric fallout from the bomb tests in 1963, scores all kinds of indicators of intelligence. The babies born in 9 months after 1963's burst of atmospheric tests, their SAT scores were showing up in 1981 as the lowest of history. And it turned out people were arguing that it was because more poor students were taking the test, but actually it was the high-scoring people who were eliminated from the SAT scores. The high scores decreased progressively in proportion to the amount of fallout being produced by the bombs.
Okay, we're going to have to call it a night, Dr. Pete, I'm afraid. I'd love to hear more, and I know a lot of other people would, but it's 1 minute to 8 o'clock now, so we've got to stop it at 8. Thank you so much for joining us yet again. We really appreciate everything you have to offer.
For more information, you can visit www.raypete.com, and you can reach us toll-free, 888-926-4372, or locally, 986-9506. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next month.
Thank you. Good night.